Okay, we're going to get started on our first Twitter space. This is the Talon University podcast. I am your host, Terry McDonald. Welcome to our first live session. With me today, we have Dr. Matthew Crandall.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And Dr. Benjamin Klasha.
Thank you, Terry.
We are all members of the Talon University International Relations faculty. And today, we're, of course, going to talk about the situation in Ukraine and the Russian invasion thereof. So, first things first, I'm going to turn to you, Matthew, and can you just give us a background on why did Russia make the decision to go through with this attack?
This is the million-dollar question that a lot of people did not think was going to happen, right? A lot of smart thinkers, a lot of Russian experts were not expecting this. Having looked at Russian foreign policy and security policies for the last 20 years, a lot of people really did not think that they would undergo this kind of attack. So it is a surprise for a lot of people, not for everybody, obviously, but for a lot of people just because of the gross escalation compared to what we've seen in past Russian behavior and the grotesque cost that Russia is now paying for this. So it is interesting why they would make this decision, as well as, you know, why they're doing it now. Those are very good questions. My only guess is that this is something that only Putin and those very close to Putin really know. Are there some kind of constraints that he is feeling that others might not know about? And then my only guess is, you know, maybe going back to the 2014 annexation of Crimea, you know, I think Putin got a taste of this imperialistic glory, mm-hmm. right? There's a lot of really interesting images, you know, him visiting Crimea, building the bridge, you know, seeing a population there that was very accepting of this, the Crimea consensus in Russia. Now, again, that doesn't count the Tatars and Ukrainians, right, who left or were forced to leave Crimea. But I think that just, you know, really convinced him that, you know, imperialistic glory was worth it.
Yeah, Ben, please.
Yeah, I'm thinking there might be some moment and you know, kind of global politics right now where it seemed to be quite convenient. We have the German leadership changing, so there's not the strong Merkel figure anymore. We have elections in France coming up, so Macron might be not so backed internally. There's of course also the Winter Olympics right now in China. So many experts before the war said that actually it would start after the Olympics, and they were kind of right. So there seemed to be this window right now with, you know, weak leadership in Europe, actually also U.S. leadership not so established with Biden as the new president, this might have been the window.
Well, I mean, part of what you bring up too, there doesn't seem to be a strong cost to some of his earlier adventurism. Why do you think this has turned out to be so different here?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now is definitely different than the past. Interventions, you know, if you look at, you know, the U.S. and Canada, you know, we have a sport, baseball, and there's three strikes and you're out. And I think, you know, every strike has escalated. Every strike has come closer to Europe. And I think, you know, this is it. I just don't think that, you know, maybe Putin was expecting everyone to kind of continue to be indifferent, but that hasn't been the case this time. And I think part of that is because of the weak responses in the past. People kind of understand that, you know, hey, we were wrong with Georgia, we were wrong in 2014, this is it.
Yeah, Ben, do you have anything to add on that?
No, actually not. The weak responses kind of invited him, and I think if we want to blame the West, as it's done a bit in certain camps, that's probably where you could start, that we have let Putin do these things. And actually, I would also add Syria to this equation. So the extreme violence that the Putin regime has shown there should have actually been, hit with some sort of reaction from the West, but it wasn't. And you know, Putin feels like he's in a law-free zone, and it's partially the fault of the West for not reacting, I believe.
And maybe also just to point out that what we're seeing now, you know, is still so radically different than what we've seen in the past. You know, I think one thing that, you know, it was different in the past. Putin, either used an opportunity of chaos and crisis, or he created chaos and crisis where people would say, well, it's just a frozen conflict, it's just a breakaway region, or, you know, we're seeing a revolution where we're just seeing this wild, mad chaos, you know, inside of the country. You know, Ukraine, before this invasion, right, was peaceful, prosperous, you know, a completely normal functioning country. There's no revolution, there's no crisis. The only breakaway regions are the ones that Russia created himself. You know, and the escalation was purely Russian, right? You don't have this narrative of, well, was it Saakashvili, you know, in Georgia that was too maybe aggressive? Did he try to take back regions or not? I mean, this was cut and dry, clean, you know, clean, black and white. And so, yeah, I mean, I don't know if Russia was lazy or impatient, but, you know, this was clearly a different adventure for the Putin regime than we've seen in the past. And we're seeing a different response than we saw in the past.
Well, on that response, to what extent do you think, say, the exclusion from SWIFT, the asset freezing and sanctions that have been put together by European, US, G7 leaders, how much do you think this is having an effect?
I mean, these are definitely the most drastic measures we have seen coming out of the West. The effect, I mean, we can see it already, but it's really going to be a long-term effect, I think, on the economic output of Russia. And hopefully, I guess that's what the West is thinking, that slowly it turns the Russian people against this regime. You know, if they're going to be effective the way they are right now, I think that's impossible to tell. It seems like the Putin regime was prepared for this to come. They expected this, maybe not to this in this degree. So my initial reaction would be that the Putin regime is not necessarily likely to change just because of these economic sanctions, because this was expected. They kind of saw it coming. They knew that this is what the West can do without interfering in this conflict militarily. Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just look at this at short-term and long-term tactics and strategies by the West, and sanctions are probably more of a long-term strategy. You know, there's a lot of examples of sanctions not working. Some examples of sanctions working, maybe the Iranian deal, right? Mm-hmm. But we'll see. I mean, you know, Saddam Hussein, for example, those were probably the most ruthless sanctions, at least in recent history. You know, some people credited the mass amount of loss of children and civilians because of those sanctions and the impact it had on the health sectors, and that did not, you know, change Saddam Hussein's mind. Now, Russia is not Iraq, right? And Putin is not Saddam Hussein. You know, oligarchs and other elites do have a greater ability in Russia, you know, if you compare it to Iraq. But that's still a concern, is that, you know, if the Russian elite have to go to the Maldives instead of Europe, and if Russian, right, babushki are having a, you know, a crunch with the value of their pensions, does Putin lose sleep over that? Maybe eventually, right, if we fast forward a few months and things continue to degrade. But in the short term, probably not. So I think that's another concern that the West needs to think about, is continuing to escalate, continuing to target, and to continue to communicate, you know, this cost-benefit according to Russian actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess part of the real difficulty, I mean, hopefully over time since Iraq, we've learned about more targeted sanctions and applying specific domestic pressure as opposed to, for example, refusing medical aid to Iraq and things like that. Now, the question is, where are the pressure points inside of Russian society that should be pushed? So, you know, they've been focusing on billionaires and oligarchs, things like that, and sensitive industry. But, of course, it goes wider than that as well. One of the big issues, of course, has been energy dependency. Matthew, I know you've done a lot about this. How do you foresee energy dependency of European countries going forward now with this turn of events?
Well, this is the 9/11 of European energy, right? I mean, this is a psychological bomb that has been dropped in the minds of policymakers. And so we are going to see a change, right? You're seeing a change in Finland, right? You know, in terms of, you know, who's able to invest in nuclear power. We saw a massive change in Germany, right? Ben, you could speak more about that, about, you know, moving up green energy targets. You're going to see a lot about LNG factories being built, about energy from other sources. So this is big, and this, you know, to be honest, I think is really the end of the Russian-European energy relationship. And I know that's a radical statement to make. I know that doesn't make sense when looking at the last, you know, 50, 70 years of Russia energy relations with Europe. But I just think that's the case. You know, I mean, you can look at the pipelines being built between Russia and China, and I think Russia's been planning this, Russia's preparing for this, and I do think this is really the beginning of the end for this European-Russian dependence or interdependence or however you want to call it.
Yeah, there might be a silver lining here, maybe, that you're forced out of the fossil fuel, the gas dependency. At least in the German discourse, it's a lot about, okay, now this is the chance to transition full-time to renewable energy. It seems, at least in Germany, so I think talking from the German perspective, the government is not willing to step back on its stance on nuclear power, though. So, you know, Germany famously is going to shut down all nuclear power plants. They're not going to go back on this and say go full on now to renewable energy, and, you know, the transition that was anyway planned hopefully happens faster now. And, you know, as I said, this is kind of a chance for Europe as well to make these steps. I also, by the way, read that the gas is still coming. In the SWIFT ban mechanisms, the West was very, you know, attentive to not, to still make sure that we can pay for gas. So the money is still going there for gas payments. And it seems like Russia is not yet, has not turned it off, as far as I know.
Well, I mean, dependency is a two-way street, right? And it's not as though Russia isn't dependent on that those sales as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And as much as we talk about them being able to transition to, for example, selling oil to China, things like that, selling gas is a complicated mechanism. You know, you need infrastructure to sell gas. You can't just switch your markets in a day. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is part of it too. Putin has long had this leverage over Europe, mm-hmm. this looming threat. But the thing about leverage in geoeconomics is the second you use it, you start using it up, right? Mm-hmm. As soon as you show that you're willing to make these sort of drastic steps, then people start making contingency plans. So the question is now, has Putin really used up his gas leverage over Europe? Is Europe really going to jump on this transition?
Mm-hmm. I think so. I think, you know, you fast forward a decade and you know, Putin's ability to use energy as a weapon will be radically reduced. You know, he's already built the, you know, the Power Siberian oil or gas pipeline to China, you know, building a second one probably by 2030. You know, and then Europe again is doing just the opposite, right? Building more LNG facilities and so on.
Yeah, if you also think of the Nord Stream 2, this seems to be done now, this project. It's not going to come back. I just saw that, you know, all workers have been released, and the Swiss company who is the main shareholder seems to be prepared to go to court now.
We're looking at insolvency today. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is not going to happen anytime soon. So this street of dependency is not coming. I saw also many European oil companies now selling all their Gazprom shares. Mm. So there seems to be a very clear cut that, you know, no more dealing with Russian gas and oil, and maybe even this is some sort of moment where we realize we shouldn't deal with authoritarian regimes in general. But then when you look around, you know,
yeah, maybe that's a big leap.
When you look around with where the gas and oil then otherwise comes from, there's not much left. But yeah,
I mean, you did see Exxon starting to make moves towards pulling out, and Exxon, of course, had about as tight a relationship with the Kremlin as one could have when it came to energy development. What role do you see Belarus playing in this situation?
Well, I think this is sad. I mean, this is another, you know, maybe development that people haven't noticed or mentioned as well, but, you know, basically Belarus has become a satellite state. You know, Belarus has, in essence, lost its sovereignty as a country. And now, obviously, Belarus has been led by, in essence, a dictator for a while, but it wasn't that many years ago when Lukashenko still tried to have some level of strategic autonomy, independence from Russia, you know, economic relations with China. But now, in essence, we're seeing him, right? Putin is dictating the terms to Lukashenko. And so at this point, Belarus has just become a satellite state of the Russian Federation. And that's a tragedy as well, I think.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I think, you know, part of it goes towards the stolen election as well, you know, and the idea that basically the whole world saw this corrupted election, the legitimate party that was supposed to win was kept out of power. And now we get to see the consequences. I mean, you go back to last year when they forced down this civilian airliner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and like all of these things, by allowing illegitimate governments to stay in power in Europe, of course, there's a question of allowing, but by seemingly them getting away with stealing an election, maintaining power, you know, it just allows a further authoritarian spread. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the satellite state observation is extremely accurate. Like, we shouldn't even think of them as so much a separate actor than the Putin regime right now. And I don't know, did you read about Belarusian forces being involved yet?
I have, which is a concern, obviously. Although mm-hmm. here, you know, when looking at strategy for the West, there still might be, maybe not, you know, maybe there could be some tactical advantage of treating them differently. You know, mm-hmm. Belarus at this mm-hmm. time is not a nuclear power. Mm-hmm. Does that give you any leeway to, whether it's sanctions or, you know, espionage or cyber attacks, to kind of act differently than you would specifically against the Russian Federation? Mm-hmm. You know, so there might be a little extra maneuverability when you're a West trying to kind of punish or retaliate versus Belarus compared to Russia. But that's probably small, and that'll also be short-lived, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know if there's how much daylight there is there, but there's also a question of how much domestic support, including militarily, that Lukashenko can rely on as well. Ben, you mentioned it already. There's been some significant German response here. Coming from Germany yourself,
Yeah. Will
you give us a little comment on that?
I mean, this is, I'm lacking the word. It's like paradigm shift doesn't even fully describe it. So you are looking at Germany that is by its constitution a pacifist state that is not supposed to have a large, you know, military that you could use for anything else than, you know, self-defense. And now in just one weekend you have a complete reversal on this. Germany, you know, most likely becoming a military power if this investment package that they have decided on, so 100 billion per year that goes now to additional to German defense, which will then go over the 2% GDP threshold that NATO was asking from Germany for so long. So we now have a complete reversal from an economic power to more of a security military power. Though I couldn't help but think also about that there are many weapon manufacturers in Germany, so potentially this is still going to increase Germany's economic power regardless. But it's an absolute, 180-degree turn. I saw this fantastic tweet. I've been quoting it all week. In one weekend, Putin killed Swedish neutrality and German pacifism. And I cannot stop thinking about it, how it's exactly the opposite of what Putin wanted to achieve probably in all of this. Now you have this very strong, united Europe, where Germany always had a leading position, we cannot deny it, and now you have a German leadership that is very concerned about its security. So I think there are also implications for the EU as a whole, to not think of them so much solely as an economic power anymore, but, you know, a power that really takes its security seriously, which is something we couldn't have said, you know, even last week ago.
Yeah. Like, Matthew, as an American, perhaps you could weigh in on what you think of your country's response so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Maybe just I'd also add, in addition to Swedish or Swiss neutrality and German pacifism, mm-hmm. Also in essence kind of created the EU army foundations, where the EU is now directly supplying weapons to mm-hmm. another country, right, sending 70 fighter jets. That's also kind of something that a lot of Europeans have been trying to do for decades. And now, you know, in a single week, we saw, you know, results that...
Although there has been some pushback. I'm not sure those fighter planes are going to go through. But anyway, go ahead, yeah.
Well, I read that the pilots were in Poland, so I hope they do. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they flew, right, if they left, but I hope so. That, I think, was a good response from the European Union, from the countries. In the media, it was 70 fighter jets. You know, that can make a difference. For the United States, their response has been steady, has been consistent, and I think in some ways that's problematic because it shows they haven't learned, right? The pre-invasion response was clear, right, that they're going to be very open about intelligence. I think that created a lot of unity in the West. It created trust, right, that the Americans, Putin did exactly as the Americans said he was going to do. They shared that intelligence also. It wasn't just public statements. And so I think that's when we look at Switzerland, when we look at Germany, that's one of the reasons we're seeing this change, is because Putin was sitting down one-on-one, lying to their face ruthlessly, mm-hmm. Right, in a despicable manner. And that kind of gives credibility to kind of what everyone had been saying pre-invasion. But then the invasion happens, and we're still seeing the same thing. And I think here the message is, the main message is that the United States, under no condition, will put troops in Ukraine. No condition, right? They don't want to risk World War III. Now, that does make some sense before the invasion, mm-hmm. right? You don't want to escalate, and obviously no one wins mm-hmm. in a nuclear war. But deterrence has failed, right? So the messaging that the West did, you know, if you invade, then we'll punish you. Putin just said, I don't care about your punishments. The goals, right, of imperialistic conquest outweigh the punishments that you can dish out. I'm going to do it anyway. And that was a learning point, I think, for a lot of people that were surprised by the invasion, is that, mm-hmm. you know, deterrence by penalty did not work. And so now what we see with the Biden administration is the exact same strategy, right? Under no, nothing that happens will lead us to have a no-fly zone, right? That's the message. And so, you know, you could argue that Putin is now thinking about, okay, well, I'll still just take any punishment you dish out, and I'm going to wage the war I want to wage. Mm-hmm. You know, I think for the American response, they need to be concerned with two aspects, right? The first is, can you defeat Russia on the battlefield? Now, obviously not directly, but indirectly, mm-hmm. right? What can you do to help the Ukrainians win this war? And the second one is, what can you do to change how Russia is waging the war? Right, so they should be communicating that says, you know, at this time, I do not foresee the implementation of a no-fly zone, because that would mean direct conflict, escalation, potentially World War III. But, you know, why are they ruling it out? They should have this little clause, you know, if Russia continues with war crimes, you know, with crimes against humanity, you know, with the use of illegal weapons, the mass destruction of civilians, you know, then we might have to reconsider, because, right, we have international obligations, right, to prevent genocide, right, the responsibility to protect, as well as the convention that they signed off on to defend Ukraine. So for the United States, they're also choosing to ignore certain international commitments. And I just think, you know, you need to leave that door open. The messaging, the communication to leave that door open is also a deterrent to change the way Putin is waging this war. Because there is a difference, right? Yeah. We're talking about how many people are going to die. We're talking about how they die. We're talking about the time it takes to rebuild a country after a war, even if the actual result of the war doesn't change. So the way in which war fights does matter, and the United States should be doing more to communicate, to respond to that. And I just haven't seen that difference, right? So the pre-war communication strategy is exactly the same now, even when we're seeing crimes against humanity, potentially, certainly mm-hmm. war crimes. And I think, to me, that's a little bit discouraging. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes, mm-hmm. But I would definitely like the United States to be a little more intensive with all of their efforts, right? Long-term kind of squeezing strategies with sanctions, mm-hmm. Short-term kind of change how Putin is waging the war, and then also let's defeat Putin on the battlefield with the use of techniques that would not invoke mm-hmm. right, World War III. And then I know I'm maybe talking a little too long, but while I'm on the subject, you know, Russia has shown for the last 15 years very clever strategies how to avoid the penalty that comes from stepping over red lines. Mm-hmm. Little green men, right? You know, frozen conflicts, gray space campaigns. And so there's a lot that the United States can do to get closer to the red line without starting World War III. You know, some would say there's ways that you can breach the red line still without invoking that kind of retaliatory response.
Use some of the Russian strategies.
Exactly, right? Mercenaries, right? Mm-hmm. Cyber weapons. You know, you don't have to have a NATO jet with a NATO pilot shooting down a Russian plane. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of other ways that you can, you know, aid the Ukrainians to defeat the Russian military.
I mean, but haven't they been supplying drones and the like? I mean, wouldn't that
They have been supplying weapons, right? And I would like to see more weapons, better weapons, especially from the United States, mm-hmm. right? Again, the European Union agreeing to send 70 fighter jets, you know, is a game changer, and that's a very significant level of technological weapons. Now, one of the biggest obstacles for the United States is that you can't send sophisticated weapons at this point in time, right? Even 6 months ago, there were concerns that there wasn't enough time to really train and mm-hmm. integrate these systems. So if you do have higher technology, you know, systems, you're going to need to send people in with them. And I think that's the concern, but that's what I'm saying is, you know, you send in the CIA, they're basically ghosts, right? You send in some private contractors. There are ways to get the systems in and then still deny accountability and say, well, hey, that wasn't us. We sold the system to the Ukrainians. And if they were able to function it, you know, then good for them. So there are still ways in which you can avoid World War III by still doing a better job of supporting the Ukrainian army.
Now, of course, we also don't know the degree to which intelligence sharing is already happening as well. It's not something that the U.S. would advertise.
Yeah.
Well, from what I know, that there is intelligence sharing going on. But I mean, I'm talking about, you know, putting in high quality air defense systems really take down the planes.
Now, so, to be fair, I'll weigh in on Canada and their response. I do think one of the things that Canada has taken the initiative in has been the freezing of the central bank assets, which, you know, is very significant, because one of the things that Russia has done for years has been building up these central bank assets so they have the ability to prop up the ruble if necessary. But, of course, when you have central bank assets, it's not like you have this, you know, vault that you're sitting on. You know, they're largely stored digitally in other banks across the world, right? So by freezing those, I think that is something that has contributed directly to this, you know, catastrophic crash of the ruble, right? So I will give the Canadian government credit on that. Minister Freeland especially has been leading one of the initiatives on this. And I think this has been an effective way for Canada to respond, meaning besides being part of larger initiatives of sending munitions, sending ration packs, closing their airspace, which of course is getting very complicated for Russian flights. I saw a flight from Kaliningrad today to Minsk. It basically had to go all like around like the horn of the Baltic.
Russian territory to go there.
So, you know, but I will say I am impressed with those efforts so far. And I will say, if you're interested in the audience out there, Tallinn University has an Estonian language series for their experts as well. And there will be an episode coming out today with Katlin Kierna. So by all means, go to tlu.ee and check that out, because you can get a real Estonian perspective there for your Estonian speakers. So we were talking about providing arms to Ukraine, Matthew. I mean, aren't there risks inherent, like, in this line? You know, how far should we be willing to go here?
You know, I think if you look at the last 70 years, you can find a surprising number of situations where nuclear powers were either engaged in armed conflict, not wars, but short battles, border skirmishes, or they came close to it. And, you know, we only have one incident where we were really close to nuclear war, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And that was really just about other nuclear weapons, right, placing nuclear weapons. And so, you know, the West isn't placing nuclear weapons in Ukraine, right? We're talking about Stingers and Javelins and, you know, what I would hope to be, you know, higher quality air defense systems, right? Some old, right, fighter jets, you know. And so I think this, you know, this is my message, you know, to the Biden administration, which, you know, he's probably not listening to this podcast, right?
But you never know.
But we hope so. Is there's a lot of room to go before you really have to worry about some of these consequences. And, you know, probably the most realistic consequence is the cyber attacks that Russia could launch, not World War III and the nuclear weapons. You know, we talk about Putin being crazy, but, you know, I do think at the end of the day that him and the people around him, you know, certainly have a desire for the Russian civilization to continue to exist. Right? I don't think they want a nuclear winter either.
And Ben, of course, recently wrote an article about possible futility of referring to Putin as an irrational actor. You want to comment on this?
Yeah, well, the point was that it might be dangerous to just call him, you know, a lunatic, irrational, that has like no sense of what he's doing. It's probably more of a situation that he has some sort of understanding of the world and a plan that he is following, that we just don't fully understand it, cannot grasp it. It's, you know, goes against what we understand as rational actions. So his kind of desire to, and of course I don't know because I'm still not Putin, but it seems a lot to recreate the Russian Empire or like something that looks a lot like it. You know, to follow this goal, you know, that's what he will continue doing. But maybe on the weapon systems, what I'm curious about is like, at what point is this still considered an act of aggression? Because Putin has been talking a lot about, you know, don't you know, be too aggressive. Finland, Sweden don't join NATO. This is an act of aggression. We had the situation where he activated the special forces now recently, which we're also not entirely sure what this means, right? But how can we say that Europe stays neutral actually by sending these weapons? At which point is it like considered, you know, we tipped over to, this is still a move of aggression in a way, and
And does Putin get to set those parameters for European behavior? You know, right? At how much should we regard Putin's analysis of the situation into constraining, Western behavior?
Mm-hmm. And I think this is the thing: is before the conflict, you know, people were worried about Russia's escalation dominance. You know, at every point they were in a pretty good position, right? They can turn off the gas. You know, they can launch cyber attacks. You know, they have nuclear weapons. But with a unified West, mm-hmm. When the gloves come off, it's not a fair fight. You know, Russia will be crushed. Yeah. And so I think that's what Russia is starting to feel, is that, you know, hey, they don't have this position of power, you know, and leverage that they thought they'd had maybe 2 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And again, with cyber attacks, right, we can take out their civilian infrastructure just as fast as they can take out ours, probably better.
And I mean, there's been a lot of that going on. It's hard to know exactly who's doing it. Anonymous has been taking credit for some of it. And of course, I mean, who knows where the line between civilian actors ends and government actors begins, you know? No one's to say that CIA isn't, you know, also in there helping shut mm-hmm. some of these things down.
This also, though, points, if we talk about the rationality once more, is that there is also a misunderstanding from Russian side about the West's rationale in all of this, that they would just, you know, let this pass again, because this has been the MO beforehand. So there was also miscalculation by the response. If we look towards Europe in particular, which was, you know, acted so united and so willful the Russia didn't seem to expect it, but certainly also the Europeans did not expect it of themselves to even act this way.
I mean, the change in 1 week from Germany and Belgium being iffy on doing the SWIFT ban to all of a sudden Germany is doubling its military spending and Switzerland is on board for bank sanctions and things like that, you know? I mean, it's been a remarkable switch.
Mm-hmm. I think what's really fascinating is, and this is more of a constructivist approach, right, that this idea of who is us and who is them changes mm-hmm. very quickly. And Putin, I think, calculated that Ukraine is not one of us, you know, in terms of the Europeans, that, you know, people in Poland, right, Portugal or Spain, mm-hmm. Italy, they're thinking, well, it's one of those, you know, post-Soviet European countries, you know, mm-hmm. tough for them, but what am I going to do? That's not the case, right? Ukraine is European, and that has changed in a week. And so I think this, it's really been fascinating, and you know, Ukraine has become a European country, and it has that level of Europeanness, the same as any other European country. Right? So that has changed in a week, in a way that we did not see in 2014 or Georgia in 2008.
And I mean, it's a credit to Zelensky as well. I mean, he's been very front and center, mm-hmm. addressing the European Parliament, use of strategic media. You know, I mean, he's really made the point that this is happening to Europe, you know? Mm-hmm. This has been like a central part of his mm-hmm. messaging on the conflict.
But it's something that I haven't quite understood yet. I've been trying to wrap my head around, like, yeah, as you said, last week, Ukraine was not part of Europe. You know, maybe at the margins of it, looking from a European perspective, European narratives, 2014, the Crimea invasion happened, and it's, you know, it's a country, you know, close to Europe, but not in it, you know, all the membership, the desire of Ukraine to join the EU was like, yeah, you're not an EU country, I don't think so. And within a week it changed. So was it the act of aggression? I'm trying to think, oftentimes identities are created vis-a-vis the other. So now in this scenario, it's very clear that the Russians, or Putin regime, is the other, and now we kind of form our identity, you know, based on that. So everything that's not Putin, that fights Putin, is basically part of us now. So somehow, I believe there, this new Europeanness, or the kind of admission of Ukraine to the European community, somehow grew out of there.
Well, I mean, you bring up an interesting transition there, mm-hmm. though. We don't have unlimited time today, folks, uncertainly. But, you know, there's been thousands of people inside of Russia arrested or detained mm-hmm. for protesting this war, you know? How do we reach out to them? Like, how does the world engage them in a way that says, okay, our problem is with the Putin regime. It is not with the Russian people themselves.
Well, that's a very difficult one, and I think people involved in sanctions regimes have been dealing with that, you know, for a long time. Some of that, I think, is communication, but that's, I think, a very difficult question. You know, and there might even be ways to try to get more communication out there. And this isn't really maybe targeting the pro-Ukrainian or anti-war, is probably a better way of saying it, the anti-war kind of protests in Russia, but, you know, trying to get more truth and information out within Russia, you know, whether it's radio or internet or, you know, other type of mechanisms so that that group can grow. There's only so many rooms in the jails, you know, so once a protest becomes, you know, overly massive, it's going to be very difficult, I think, for Russia to just ignore that.
Well, see, Alexei Navalny today put out a series of tweets much along these lines, saying that, you know, if it requires us flooding the paddy wagons and the jails, you know, to stop this war, well, then this is what is our moral obligation to do for the Russian opposition. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, no one knows better than him the costs of going against the Russian regime as well. So.
Yeah. It's something I noticed definitely with myself, and I guess this is in a way the Western viewpoint of this, is that I kind of didn't believe what type of state Russia really is in the end. Like, you know, actually, if I were to put it in political science term, the level of fascism or the fascist regime level, that the there is absolutely no free, you know, voicing your opinion, and the police is, you know, very powerful. So it's the Secret Service. And even though I had a feeling this is how it is, but I still did not fully believe it somehow. And I feel like this is projects to the whole conflict. Like, we saw the Russian army at the border, but we still did not fully believe the facts, or just couldn't believe them. And now it's like all coming down on us, and well, how to react to it? Yeah, I don't know.
It's a scary deal, right? Even the Soviet Union had the Politburo and had mechanisms for removing someone from power, right? You look at Khrushchev, you know, for example, after the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's no mechanism for, you know, getting Putin out, and that's a little concerning when we try to, you know, think about what happens next.
Yeah, and, you know, one thing we should talk about, of course, is, like all conflicts, this is going to create great flows of people, mm-hmm. you know. There's going to be, we've seen since the day of the invasion, there's been lineups of cars trying to get to the border. There's going to be a large influx of people at Europe's borders. Mm-hmm. How do you think this is going to affect the European Union?
I mean, right now, the European Union seems actually to have, another 180-degree turn on their migration policy or dealing with refugees. So as long as you come from Ukraine and have a Ukrainian passport, you can come in, and you can, you know, you don't even have to go through asylum, through the process right away. Mm. So the EU response on that level has been, you know, quite different than before, and, you know, I certainly support. Yet at the same time, and this is also quite, well, unfortunate, sad, upsetting, is the fact that, you know, African students and Ukraine were not, you know, allowed to just join that easily. The EU, I hope the situation is better at the border now. That's at least what I understand. But thinking also of the general turn of migration policy, so if you come from Ukraine, which is now a European country, and you're a refugee, you can come in, you can do what we want here, our European values. If you come from another country, particular from the Middle East, from Africa, so from not clearly non-European, then it's a very different story. So the EU and Europe has quite shown its racist face, I would say, here, that there are two class of refugees. First class refugees who can come in, they can get all the benefits. Second class refugees cannot come in at all. So this has been quite upsetting, I think. It, you know, tells the Europeans that there's still some homework maybe for us to do. There's still some ways to rethink our, you know, imperialistic, you know, thinking of the world, that there are, you know, Europe is superior in some sort of way, and others are not. So I'm thinking of these colonial past that are still clearly there, and then expressed in this racism at the border. So Europe still has some work to do. At the same time, we are pointing at Russia, who wants to build an empire and uses this kind of colonial language, colonial narratives. Ukraine has always been part of Russia, and let's reestablish the Russian Empire. So I would be very self-critical as a European here and say that, you know, we still have also this empire thinking in a way, at least looking back at the past, that has kind of created how the world works today. So quite some work to do for the Europeans on that level.
Well, one of the things, Matthew, and I'll let you weigh in here, is there has been, of course, reports, like Ben was mentioning, of Indian students, African students, workers from other countries still fleeing the conflict, but having trouble getting out of the country, be it Ukrainian border guards or in Europe. How do you think this is going to affect overall perception of the values of this conflict?
Well, I mean, I think this is certainly, very important, and I very much agree with Ben that there's a very fascinating difference between when the refugees are perceived as being us, as one of us, mm-hmm. versus, the Syrian conflict when it was the refugees were someone else, the other, night and day reaction. But I think this reminds us that this is a global conflict. The idea that it's just little Ukraine and Russia just, having a bone to pick with its little brother, mm-hmm. that is absolutely false, right? Tens mm-hmm. of thousands of foreigners, China, India, right, countries that might want to be neutral in this conflict, when they're dealing with thousands of their own citizens, some mm-hmm. dying in the conflict, one student from India was already reported being killed. So it definitely makes this a global conflict, and it means these other countries have skin in the game. Maybe just one also point that I think is important is when we talk about other citizens, I certainly would hope that there is, fair and equal treatment. They are still war refugees, right? They've still lived through the bombs just like anyone else, but they do still have a homeland to go back to. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, they were, warned like all most foreign citizens that, hey, they should leave the country because a war is coming. You can't say that to the Ukrainians because they didn't have anywhere to go to. That was their home. So mm-hmm. there is a little clarification, I think, that, some foreign citizens, would have the option to go back to their home country, whereas Ukrainians do not. But that doesn't change the fact that many of them might not have the means to go back to their home country. They mm-hmm. may have been gone for 20 years, right?
Or haven't had the opportunity up to this point because it's a war zone. Yeah.
Right. And again, they're living through the same war zone as everyone else. So I think certainly it's in Ukraine's best interest for their society to treat these people with respect, and certainly the European Union and Polish officials and everyone along the way. So that's certainly, I think, a point to work on, as Ben mentioned, for the West.
Going back to some of our international relations institutions, mm-hmm. There's been a lot, of course, talk at the United Nations about this, but, any resolution to deal with this on a Security Council level is, of course, vetoed by Russia.
Yeah.
I mean, what does this say about the continued utility of, the United Nations as an institution in, and an actor in international affairs?
Yeah, we were just discussing, Matthew and I, before we started, whether there might be any mechanism in the UN even to expel a country. And if there is one, okay, potentially, but to expel a country from the Security Council, that's probably not in the, in the charter. And at which point is the kind of moral obligation of the West, of Europe, so high that they cannot further, they cannot look away? Because usually when we have a moral obligation, we look to the Security Council and get kind of the mandate, you can act on this now. But in this case, it's not there. So will there be this moment where, the moral weight is so big, you have to kind of ignore the veto?
Well, I think the closest we can see in history is maybe the flip from kind of mainland China to Taiwan in terms uh-huh. of who gets the UN security seat. But that was a very specific circumstance. This one, doesn't have that kind of legal, who has the sovereignty. I mean, Russia is Russia. So that's a very challenging
Well, I mean,
one.
There is an interesting There's, argument yeah. about mm-hmm. if Russia should be in the standing to inherit the USSR's, P5 seat, having one of the vetoes. But that's, of course...
So just transfer that vote to Ukraine as the legal successor to the Soviet. That would be an interesting legal argument, yeah. I think for me, the closest thing we get is really more the Balkan conflicts in the 90s, where you have illegal but legitimate action, where also the UN Security Council couldn't do anything, and Europe just kind of said, well, just because Russia's against it doesn't mean we have to sit and watch crimes against humanity unfold. Now, obviously, that was against Serbia, not against the Russian Federation itself. Mm-hmm. But I think that might be the closest comparison is, mm-hmm. you know, the UN is paralyzed, and I think the chance of fixing it now are, you know, slim to none, maybe at some point in the future.
But, I mean, of course, there's also questionable value if you kick out, you know, the world's largest, second largest nuclear power from the Security Council.
Yeah.
How much can the Security Council actually speak for the world global security, right? You know, same as, okay, say if we had thrown out Russia now, if we had thrown out the second Bush era America after the Iraq invasion, I mean, mm-hmm. if you didn't have these major mm-hmm. military powers there, there's of limited utility as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so we're running out of time here, but first of all, I want to thank everyone for joining us out there in Twitterland. So, what has changed in international relations since the start of this conflict? Like, Matthew, we spoke on this issue in late December, and, you know, so much has gone on since then. Like, mm-hmm. what do you see as having changed in international relations since the actual onset of conflict in this?
Well, I think, you know, this is still a question that is to be continued, and maybe here I'll just kind of say a lot of this will depend on countries like India and like China, mm-hmm. and how they respond. Do they kind of go about things as business as usual? Obviously, conflict has been going on for a long, long time. Proxy wars, balance of power. You know, you've seen worse conflicts than this. You know, maybe not in terms of military, but in terms of loss of life and whatnot. So we'll see, but I think definitely we're seeing a radical shift, mm-hmm. and we're seeing, you know, certainly an end of this kind of post-Cold War era, the last 30 years.
Yeah.
And we'll have to see. Maybe it'll be a bigger loss. I think that's the job of the West right now is, you know, it's a war to maintain a state-based world order and to prevent us from going into a war of empires. Now, again, maybe, you know, you could have some voices from the global south that say, well, you know,
yeah.
maybe, you know, I'm overstating that kind of state-based
element. Not to say that there hasn't been previous elements of that in the last 30 years, you know, that might have got washed over. Yeah.
But I do think, you know, kind of this level of imperial aggression that, again, isn't just in terms of owning resources, but actual taking land is very, you know, we haven't seen that since World War II in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, it's very big, and I hope that the West prevails, that we don't see a return to an era of empires, and that states continue to have the right to exist. I think coming from a small state, you know, if you look at the history of the international system, again, at least the state system, you know, there have been periods of time where it's good and easy to be a small state, and others where it's very dangerous and difficult to exist as a small state. And, you know, we're seeing that also in the conflict right now.
Okay. Ben?
Yeah, I can't help to think also about this idea of multipolarity, that we have several great powers in the world, and Russia was certainly considered one in this model. And now I'm looking at it, is it going to be brandmarked as a rogue state in a way, kind of, you know, not part of this international community anymore? We see China kind of turning its way back a little bit towards Russia, so there was some partnership perhaps building. Now they seem to be, not very straightforward, but stating that there are no allies. So Russia seems to be quite isolated on the international sphere. And then I'm looking at Europe, which really, you know, unified, and it looks like will come stronger out of this conflict. So do we now look at a world where we have the United States as one kind of power? You have Europe more clearly formed as a power in China. So do we look more at a multipolar world actually now out of this conflict? So is the bipolarity, if it ever was there, is kind of gone. Those are some of my thoughts. And if I may add one more thing, I was this morning reading about realism, and John Mersheimer gave an interview, and he try to justify this whole conflict just by Washington playing against Moscow, and that's kind of all that matters. And he tried to fit everything that's going on into this narrative of just two great powers fighting. But to what you said, Matthew, like the sovereignty of Ukraine has to matter in all of this, and you know, the sovereignty of smaller states have to matter in all of this. So if I think of IR as a discipline, like you know, is this another piece of evidence that, you know, great power politics, offensive realism, is this maybe something that is kind of over? We should look to other theories to help us understand.
Yeah. And for me, like, This is sort of the beginning of a post-Trump era of international relations. It maybe seems like the West has finally been shaken to accept the fact that it's not 1992 anymore, you know, and that if there is going to be democratic peace in the world, then it's going to have to be something that's going to be consciously chosen and striven for, you know, that I don't think just sitting around and waiting for the end of history, you know, to use the old cliche, is going to work. Yeah. If democracies are going to be protected, they're going to have to protect each other. No one else is, there's no referee to appeal to. That I think democracies are going to have to make conscious, active choices to support other democracies around the world. So, you know, you've seen the Biden administration work towards this. When it comes to, like, for example, they had their Summit of Democracies last winter, and I think this is something that you're going to see as just a closer and closer and more conscious decision for democracies to be active participants and define themselves as such. That will be, you know, the new coalition.
Yeah, very appreciate that, Terry.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for joining us, guys. Matthew, thank you so much for coming on again. Ben, you'll be coming on a new episode soon.
Yes. And pleasure to be here, Terry, every time.
Thanks to everyone listened out there in Twitterland. We're going to save this one and release it as a special episode of the Talon University podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Talon Podcast. I'm sure we'll be sharing a link to this afterwards. So thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you again in the future.